everybody. This is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
Welcome to the Invested Podcast, where we are deep into understanding Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, the best investors in the world who basically are trying to, in the most reliable possible way, produce high returns with low risk.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
This is real interesting how this goes. I mean, everybody knows stocks outperform every other asset that there is by, you know, exponentially. And yet the problem with stocks is that they, if you just buy and hold, particularly in times like this, where the market just keeps going up and up and up and up and looks, feels like a helium balloon waiting for a pin, you run the risk of being in a portfolio that drops 50% just when you most desperately don't want it to, and might not recover for 10 years or even as long as, say, 26 years, which has happened once.
That's a terrifying prospect.
It is a long time to break even, isn't it?
Yeah. And,
I mean, think about the people that are putting their money in a 30-year T-bill at in some parts of the world, they're putting their money into a 100-year T-bill at a 1% interest rate or a 0% interest rate. It's like, what? So, I mean, it's just like you want to have a reliable way of doing well with your capital, but you want to be able to do well in your lifetime, right? Not 200
right.
years.
Right.
So this is the way. As far as every bit of research I've been able to do, the best investors in the world do this. And this is the only way that I've ever seen. This is the only way
this
that
being,
you can have replicable results. But this, by this, I mean investing by buying something that has value that you know within a range. You understand what it's worth and you pay substantially less than that for it.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk today about the Daily Journal meeting that Charlie Munger just led. And one thing that he actually answered in that meeting was basically like, what is value investing? And he said, it's buying something for less than its value. Like, period.
Right.
Whether that's a crazy growth stock. And it was in the context of like, is it possible to even be a value investor in this market right now? And
right.
and so he meant, you know, even if it's a crazy growth stock, even if it's something that you're paying more than like a typical valuation might tell you, as long as you think you're paying less than what its actual value is, that's value investing. I thought that was really interesting.
And then I think Warren goes farther and says that there is no other kind of investing than value investing. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's back up a little and talk about what we're talking about here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So there were two big sort of value investing guru events in the last few days, which almost never happens. It was kind of a crazy week. So we had Charlie Munger talking at the Daily Journal annual shareholder meeting on Wednesday last week, if I have that right.
The Daily Journal is Charlie's, I say Charlie's company. It's a public company, but he owns it.
He's the chairman and... Yeah. I don't think he really like runs it. I don't think he's really all.
Oh no,
that.
He doesn't run it.
Yeah, I think he even says multiple times, like, I don't really have anything to do with this business.
And,
but
and interestingly enough, I also really don't know what these people do.
So. So if you're somebody who missed that, you can go watch the video. Yahoo Finance streamed it. So if you just look online or on YouTube or whatever for Yahoo Finance Daily Journal meeting 2021. It'll come up. It's about 2 hours and it's well worth the time. And then the other thing that my dad's referring to is that the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder letter came out recently that Warren Buffett writes every year. And Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett are investing partners, have been most of their lives. And Charlie Munger is the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway. So,
and the Berkshire letter is an annual event that's much awaited by all the fans. And all these letters are posted up on the Berkshire Hathaway website. You just go to you know, Google Berkshire Hathaway, mm-hmm. and you can't miss it. It's like right there in front of you, Chairman Letters. When you click that link.
It's the most bare bones website, and it makes me love them so much.
Oh, yeah. It has nothing.
They do not expend money on that website.
A handful of links. You click on the link, and then there you are with a pile of links. More. And and you click on the year you want to read. And those letters, I'm sure we've referred to these many times here over the 5 years, but they are just an education of their own. If you want to get a really good education in Rule 1 style investing, what we call Rule 1 investing, that's the place to go. And by the way, the reason we call it Rule 1 investing.
I would call it Buffett style investing.
I call it Rule 1 investing.
If you're going to go read Buffett's letters, Rule you're learning about Buffett investing.
Rule 1 investing is what I call it. And the reason I do is because these guys don't really want to call it value investing, although that's the most common thing everybody calls it, because value investing connotes a different kind of investing that goes back to Buffett's mentor, Ben Graham, who in the Depression and World War II was able to buy many, many companies for less than the cash that they have on their books, net the debt, right? Subtract the debt. And you have cash, and you're paying less than that for the business. And he would buy 100 of them, 200 of them at a time that he called kind of cigar butt investing, picking up stuff that's nearly free. And it goes along with a fundamental of good Rule 1 investing, which is don't lose money. The fundamental rule of investing is don't lose money. Don't worry or focus on making money. Don't try to make money.
Where does that rule come from, Dad?
Oh, that's Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
Right there. Okay, fair enough. Buffett's got two rules of investing. Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. And what we find is that most people don't take that seriously. They actually are out there trying to make money. And it's really hard, actually, to try not to try to make money.
I mean, because, come on, course, aren't we all? Please.
And we are, and that's a mistake. That's a fundamental error that is corrected by remembering that rule number one is the only rule of investing. Don't lose money. And if that's true, then why would you consider anything at all about trying to make money when the whole rule is don't lose it? And if you think about that another way, Monash Pabrai says, oh, we just want free lottery tickets. Same idea. That's all there is. We don't know where it's going to go. We might win big, but we won't lose anything, or we won't lose much. And that idea has got to permeate your consciousness. It's got to be something you just, your whole investing world is colored by those colored glasses that you're looking through. And when that happens, you become a much, much better investor. You stop making mistakes. That's the key thing. Mm. And when you stop making mistakes, then the stuff that you get right, and it might be 4 out of 20, but if you don't lose on those 16, those 4 will make you rich.
Yeah. Again, at the Daily Journal meeting, that reminds me that Charlie was asked about Sequoia, which is a venture capital firm. And he, I don't even remember what the question was exactly, but it was basically like, you recently said Sequoia was the best investment firm in the world.
Well, it's a mutual fund.
Sequoia is a venture capital fund.
Sequoia is a mutual fund.
Okay, then he's talking about something completely different because his answer was all about a venture capital fund.
Really? Pretty sure?
Okay, now because, I'm like 80% sure.
Okay, because what happened back in the 60s is that Buffett shut off. He had 12 limited partnerships that he used to build his wealth with, right? He would create a partnership, initially friends and family. And then he added another one and another one as his reputation grew, and he managed this money, and he made a fortune because he took 25% of the profits out of the partnership, and he just didn't charge.
But
a
he
fee.
Didn't charge any fees, yeah.
Right, no fees. And by the way, I mean, this is a worldwide podcast, so everybody be sure and check with your securities people because it's different everywhere. But in the United States, back when Buffett did this, was the 1950s. When I did something similar to that, it was the 1980s, and it was still okay to do it. You could have a small number of unsophisticated investors, and Buffett actually makes that point in his letter this time, that these were unsophisticated investors that he started with. And this is a very big no-no as far as the SEC is concerned, is that, oh my God, you wouldn't want to have unsophisticated investors. By the way, they consider an unsophisticated investor all of you. Doesn't matter how much you've studied, doesn't matter how much knowledge you have about investing. What matters is, how much money do you have? That's how the SEC decides you're sophisticated.
Yeah.
And the reason they do that is because they assume that if you've got $2 million, which is the minimum degree of sophistication required for a hedge fund, they call it a qualified investor, they assume that you've got the money to hire someone who actually is sophisticated and can make a decision for you. Okay, I get it. On the other hand, they have foreclosed this avenue for both the person that's investing with a Warren Buffett and the new Warren Buffett himself.
And how does this come to Sequoia? What was Sequoia?
Oh,
how was
so
Sequoia
I'm getting
relating
to
the early stage stuff?
I'll get there. Hmm? I'm trying to get there, but I just want to make this point. I want you all to go write your local state. If you're in the United States, write or call your securities people at your state. Just look it up in the state.gov website and there'll be securities. And get an email to them, get a letter to them, and tell them that they've tightened up regulations too much. And now you can only have, for example, 6 unaccredited investors in Georgia before you have to get licensed. And in the moment you get licensed, you can't have anything but qualified investors unless you register a public offering. And it's just ridiculous. And it has gotten so tight that you can't do what Warren Buffett did and you can't do what I did anymore, which is to go out to people who are unsophisticated investors, get a small number of them putting in a small amount of capital with you and start to build your reputation and gradually get more and more capital. So,
it's a good thing that everybody listening to this podcast is learning how to invest on their own, right?
Right, but I just see this as such a wonderful way to get wealthy. Okay, onward.
Yeah.
So, Warren Buffett has 12 partnerships-ish, I think he wrote, and he combined them all into one by, 1962 or three. And by the late 60s, he was, I think, a bit fed up with managing people's money who kept insisting that he keep doing 36% a year every year in and out when he preferred to sit in cash. And so he decided to go out after a really good year and he closed the Buffett partnerships, and he recommended people do one of three things. Number one, they could F off, which was actually, he didn't say it like that, but that was one choice. Go do whatever you want with your money. Choice number two, put it into this little company that Buffett was loading everything he owned into called Berkshire Hathaway at $16 a share. It's now $350,000 a share or something. Or number three, put it into the new fund being started up by his friend, the Sequoia Fund. This is a mutual fund that ran for, 30 years, 30, it's still going.
Who was that? I'm trying to remember his name. It was a really famous, really
super famous
investor.
Guy. We'll hear about it multiple times over.
I wonder if Sequoia really was the name of that fund.
I assume so, because they did about 18% a year for 30 years.
It totally could be. Yeah, we should Google that. But I just looked up the question that I was thinking of from the meeting. It's 100% about Sequoia Capital, which is a venture capital company in Menlo Park. So the whole answer is about venture capital. it's about early stage investing.
Oh my God.
So there were a couple questions about where he brought it up. And the first one was asking whether it's better to invest early in a company. And this is a question that we actually contemplate constantly on this podcast. Is it better to invest early in a company or wait until a company is a clear winner of a mature industry? And what he says is that just he and Warren are way better at buying mature industries than at finding startups. And he says, like Sequoia is good at finding startups. He says they're probably the best VC operation. They're really good at early stage investing. And he says, for some folks, early stage investing is best. And for other folks, what I've done in my life is best. And then the follow-up question was that he said, you've said recently, Sequoia is the greatest investing firm ever. Do you think this time in the market, I'm completely paraphrasing all of this, by the way. Do you think this time in the market is different and conventional valuation is dead, or is this like 99 and it's all going to crash? And what he says is, I don't try and compete with Sequoia. He says, you can argue that I got close to Sequoia when Li Lu and Munger got into BYD when it was very small. And he says it was not a startup, but it was so small and thinly traded, we were buying into a venture capital type investment, but in the public market. So he says, with that one exception, I've stayed out of Sequoia's business because they're so much better at it than I would be. And I don't know how to do it the way they do it. I just, like, over and over, every answer, I think the reason he's so venerated at 97 is he just constantly says what he doesn't know. He's not somebody who's trying to put himself forward as an expert. Like, probably the world's foremost expert on value investing, and he's not trying to put himself forward as an expert. He's saying, I don't know how an early stage investor does this so well. Like, I wouldn't be able to do it. I stick to what I'm good at. Right. And he just straight up, he doesn't try to pretend like, oh, if I went into early stage, I'd be able to figure it out. He's like, I'd suck at it, basically. I just love that he's so attentive to never saying that he thinks he could do something.
Truth. He's so attentive to truth. And I don't think he would deny he's one of the best in value investors in the world. No question.
Yeah. No, I think he believes that of himself.
And by the way, to catch up, you're right. Sequoia, I'd completely forgotten. Sequoia is a Menlo, you know, probably Sand Hill Road venture capital company that got early stage in, I don't know how early stage they got in different things, but they got into Google, that's for sure.
They're very well known. It was
run
by
Don Valentine.
They've been around a long time.
I don't know if you caught that.
Sorry, I didn't. What did you say?
Same time, not even listening to me.
Yeah.
So Don Valentine is the founder of it, and he died last year.
Oh.
So hard to say how they'll go, right, from here.
It's a huge operation. Right. Yeah, it is. It is.
But I guess Valentine really hasn't had control of it for 20 years or something. So it's rocking and rolling. And that is different than Sequoia Mutual Fund, which is what I thought Charlie was talking about. Should have.
So that one is called Sequoia. The other one.
The mutual fund.
The mutual fund that you were thinking of that came out of the early Berkshire, the early Buffett partnership.
Yep. And it's Bill Ruane that started.
Bill Ruane, that's who it is.
Who is phenomenal. So there's two Sequoias, and they're in very different businesses, right? So the Sequoia Mutual Fund, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, they're in the business that I'm in. I'm in the business of what we call Rule One investing or value investing. And again, just real quickly, the reason we call it Rule One investing and not value investing is because there's this connotation that value investors have to buy companies when they're like at a single digit PE ratio or something, right? And we don't. I mean, we owned Google, we've owned Apple. It's just we're looking for things of value, what we can buy that's cheaper than what it's worth.
It's Mungerism.
It's Mungerism. Really? Right. Okay. Don't call it Rule One just because I do.
Okay. Rule One.
Fair enough.
Made me think of that question, or his answer to that question, was that you said you look to not lose money. And in the way that you think of that is if you own 20 companies and 16 of them don't do much, but they don't go down, and the other four are big winners. That's a really early stage investor type of structure. That's a really venture capital type of structure. It really is. They buy a small number of companies. Yeah, this is just fact. They tend to buy a small number of companies in a fund. If one or two hit it big, that is everything they ask for. And then if eight of them, well, this is different than the don't lose money thing. If eight of them fail.
Right.
They don't care.
When now that we think about it.
Okay, that is different, to be fair. But the point is the other one to two pay for all the rest.
That part is similar.
That part is similar.
I've done venture capital back really right You were about 4 years old or so. So I was doing some venture capital. And the key to it was that when you win gigantically huge. It's like win, you know, 80% per year compounded for a decade kind of win, right?
Yeah,
kind of
thing. Huge.
And that makes up for the losers. But the average venture capital, the not average, the successful venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, I read once, I don't know how true this is, but I read once they're hitting around 28 to 30% compounded over time, which is phenomenal.
I mean, for VC, that's like what they need to be hitting for the amount of risk that investors take. That's what an investor generally would expect from a venture capital fund.
And by the way, if you wanted to know if you were going to go out and be an entrepreneur and you wanted to go raise money from a venture capitalist, from an angel investor who is essentially a single office venture capitalist willing to willing to put their own money into deals and offer some substantial help on the board. If you were going to go do that, you would want to probably understand why they're going after such high chunks of your business, right? I mean, why do they demand 63% of your company or 37% of your company? How do they come up with that number? And this is the answer, is that they're trying to figure out how much of that they need to take in order to get the kinds of returns they got to get when it wins. Is essentially how it boils down. Did you ever do any M&A stuff where they, or any of your legal work where you did venture capital and they were trying to figure out how much to own of this business?
I mean, as a low-level associate, no, I never got to chat on them with their valuation structures. But, I mean, I did a lot of deals where we were buying chunks of companies or selling companies.
Yeah.
That stuff happens before it gets to the lawyers usually.
I mean, the entrepreneurs always feel like they're getting screwed or often feel that way back in the days when I was doing it, because there wasn't anywhere near the kind of understanding about venture capital that there is today. Now it's phenomenal. I think if there's one thing that makes America great in the world and will keep us great in the world, it's that we have the largest private venture capital available for entrepreneurs by orders of magnitude to anyone else in the world.
Yeah.
And the only China obviously is government run capitalism, if you will. I mean, sort of, I guess, which is a classic definition of fascism if you look it up.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're a communist, quote, communism, but they run in a fascist country. And they essentially could be the venture capital arm of these new ventures, but they're not. They bank them. They put banking money out there, but they've sort of left it to the entrepreneurs to put venture money out. And eventually they'll catch up with us in that regard. I'm quite sure. They've got so many, you know, wealthy people that have gotten wealthy over the last three decades that money then turns around and becomes venture capital money. And that's just how it works in a capitalistic system, is that your risk capital comes from people who've gotten rich. So, you know, hopefully we'll have more and more of those, because that's where jobs come from. That's, I put it more succinctly, that's where real wealth comes from. I mean, a government can go create jobs. Here, dig this ditch. Here, you know, chop trees down and make a trail in the forest. That's a job that the government can create. What the government doesn't do at all is create wealth. They don't know how to do that.
Right, right.
So you create wealth when you invest in Apple Computer, and suddenly you have cut out every secretarial job in the country, and every executive is doing their own secretarial work, or you've chopped out all of this design stuff that used to be done on paper, or you're a Pixar, and all of a sudden you can build a movie in your studio. I mean, it's just, it goes on and on what entrepreneurs have done in this country to create wealth. And that makes us so strong and so competitive. And we should never forget that. It is a gigantic advantage in the world.
I completely 1,000% agree with that.
We never want to have a taxation structure that penalizes that.
Well, and Charlie got a question. I don't remember the exact question. Something like, you know, like, how can we really trust our money being in Chinese companies? Like, you have a lot of money in Chinese companies. How do you trust that that's not going to be, it was related to Jack Ma being disappeared for a while. And they were asking, like, do you worry about BYD's assets being nationalized or the company itself being nationalized?
Right.
And what he said basically was, the Chinese are very smart, and they have created a system in which people have become extremely wealthy in a communist country that is run like a capitalist country, which, as you said, is fascism by the definition. He didn't say that part. And because they clearly have this plan to create millionaires and billionaires, and for the wealth even to be passed down, he pointed out that they don't have a wealth tax in a communist country. They don't have a wealth tax.
Right.
That he thinks that their goal is to not nationalize companies. They want to make sure that people are incentivized to continue to create wealth in the way that you just described.
Yeah.
I mean,
highly likely.
I still think, like, there's a danger just because you never know, but I get his point, and I think it's well taken. Just because
if you own, I don't know how Charlie owns BYD. He may own it directly through Li Lu via Hong Kong or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it might be a legitimate stock. I mean, by that, I mean they actually own the stock of the company BYD. But when you own stock in Tencent and JD and Alibaba, you don't own the stock that is the company. What, and many people don't, they don't realize that.
Yeah, we've talked about that here.
You own a VIE that's sitting in the Cayman Islands, which has a right to the earnings.
Yeah.
And it's illegal in China. So could they pull the cork on all these investors? Sure. They could do it tomorrow.
That'd be an interesting question to ask Charlie about. Maybe we should submit that one next year.
I think what he would say is what he said. Why would they? I mean, why would they kill the goose?
That's true.
Why would they kill the goose?
You're right. The second they do that, every non-Chinese investor never invests in a Chinese company.
Exactly.
Again.
Done.
Until they change something.
So all that outside capital just disappears. So
That's true. Very unlikely. They're very practical, I think, is what he was trying to say.
Yes.
Very, very logical and practical.
So what else did Charlie say that you did that struck you? I mean, because we've watched Charlie for a million years and don't really expect anything amazingly new out of what he's talking about.
Yeah, I don't think he said a lot of amazingly new stuff. I think it was short answers, I noticed. He really didn't go on anything. Mm-hmm. And he finished it right at the, hour and 50 minute mark, and then gave a little closing talk, and I don't think he really said that much that was like really extraordinary that hadn't been said before. What stuck out to me was, just because this is something I care about, he answered a few questions about culture of a company, about management, and he said multiple times how important the culture of a company is, how important the management is. He mentioned that Costco's culture is really what propelled it to be the incredible company that it is today. Yes. And he said that Jeff Bezos is, in his opinion, either the or one of the greatest businessmen that has ever been around. Yep. So he, I notice when people talk about that stuff, because that's what I look for in companies. So that was really interesting to me to hear somebody who's so not... He's not somebody who's out there like chatting about ESG and mission and purpose-led companies and all that kind of stuff. So when he talks about company culture, what he means is a company, as he said straight in the beginning, a company that sells things to people that are good products that make their lives better. And that's it.
Well, a couple of points here that I picked up. One is that Charlie was very clear that the stock market in the United States is in a major bubble.
Yeah.
And that nobody knows how long it's going to last. And that's the two things. It's like, yes, it's a bubble. It's looking for a pen, and nobody knows where that pen is.
Yeah.
Number one. And the second thing that came out of Buffett's letter, which we haven't talked much here, but it's really worth checking out, is how reticent Buffett was to say anything really about who's going to follow him if he dies.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Yeah.
why he's not paying dividends. I mean, that people at Barron's were like, you should be paying dividends and drive the stock price and all this. And, you know, honestly, there was a pretty good get together with Guy Spier following that meeting. And one of the things that came out of it was over on Clubhouse was that Warren is talking his book. I mean, Warren wants some good companies to buy, and they're not viable at this market, number one. So why pump up the market? Why would you, if you want to buy hamburger, why would you pump up the price of hamburger? You wouldn't. And the second thing is, in lieu of buying other good companies, he'll buy his own. And he bought a nice chunk of it last year.
He did,
and
yeah.
Why would you pump up the company? Why would you pay dividends and get people pumping up the stock price if what you want to do is buy the stock if it's going to drop? In other words, Buffett never plays down Berkshire, but he doesn't play it up either. And he wasn't playing it up in this letter in the least. And
well, that's interesting. I felt the opposite.
Really? You thought he was pumping Berkshire?
Yeah, I thought pumping the stock I thought price? The letter... Oh, not the stock price. No, no. I mean, he never does that. At least that maybe a long time ago. I don't know. No, my impression was that it was a lot of kind of, and maybe this is to your point that it was more about just talking up the company. I don't know. But to me, what struck me is it felt like it was a letter about legacy, because he talked a lot about the companies that Berkshire has not only just owned, but the way Berkshire has really shaped the major companies that they own. Sometimes he talks about the smaller companies in his letter, and this time he didn't do that. He talked about the big companies. He talked about the railroads. He talked about the insurance, very briefly the insurance, actually, because he's had other letters where he really got into it. And he really talked about Berkshire Hathaway Energy and the... huge investment that company has put into greener energy, literal investment, billions. And I just thought,
I caught the theme was the middle part of America.
Yeah,
is massively contributing to the wealth of America. It's not all about the coasts, and he just pointed one company after another that has produce enormous wealth for people, and they're built by wonderful people, and they're built by Nebraskans, and they're built by, right? Wasn't that
totally
so deep on it? I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
And then Barron's comes out after that letter, and he goes, everything was missing from this that was important. You know, what succession and underperformance? You know, why didn't you talk about the underperformance of your shares? This is where I was thinking. It's like, why would he? If he wants to buy his stock back, you know? And also it occurred to me that Barron's is talking about the last 5 and 10 years, how his stock has done against the S&P 500, and it's lagged it. And guess what? Buffett forever, going back 60 years, has been saying that when the stock market's on fire, we are going to lag performance. Berkshire will not be able to compete with a bull market stock market. And the reason for that is because what we try to do when we're buying companies is we try to buy companies that are on sale, and the stock market is running at a 2% earnings yield. I mean, it ain't on sale. Very hard to buy stuff, and very hard to do anything but underperform. And it's been like that for a decade now. So why would he? I don't know.
I don't know. I just can't think of a time where he's talked up the price of. I guess occasionally he's said, "Oh, you know, it's at a good book value." I don't know.
I think he just kind of stayed away from it this time.
Yeah.
Barron's was saying like this was just too much of a trip down memory lane. And I thought he was basically pointing out why we do what we do.
Yeah, I took it that way exactly. Why we do what we do, that we've done good things with our companies, that we continue to do good things with our companies, that we employ people, that we've done the right thing.
Yep.
He pointed out that the new CEO of... Is it BHE or is it the railroad? I can't remember. Is a woman, Katie Farmer. I mean, you know, I really felt like it was a legacy kind of letter. Look at what I've done. And he would never say it like that or think of it like that even. I don't think it's about him. But that's, I mean, it is about him for all of us who follow him.
And, well, it's, and Katie, she is Burlington Northern. But
Burlington Northern.
Beyond that, look at how he, I mean, I think this is why I think he was playing it down. He made a thing out of losing, out of writing down $10 billion on precision cast parts, which is this purchase that he made. And then he goes into really quite a lot of mea culpa about having paid too much. It's nobody's fault but mine, but I paid too much for it, you know, in terms of blah, blah, blah. And really, the company just got crushed because why? They're making parts for airplanes and they nobody's flying. So it'll come back. What he didn't say was we made $1 bazillion on Apple.
Oh, he did say that.
Well, he didn't really. I mean, he didn't really come out and just go, hey.
He said, you know, we bought some, what was it, like 5.2% of the company, and then Apple bought some of their shares back, and then we bought some of their shares back, and boom, you guys made an extra $1 billion without doing anything.
In the context of the buybacks, yes, but not in the context of we bought it at 100 and it went to 500.
Right.
Right? He didn't say that. He didn't say that this is by far our largest investment and massively overshadows the losses that we took on precision cast parts.
Yeah.
Most everybody, including me, would do exactly that. And he doesn't. And the reason, honest to God, the reason he doesn't is because he wants this stuff to go down. I really believe it. He's not pumping his book at all.
But that's also the way he writes every letter ever.
Yeah.
This is not. True. But so when you say, like, there's a reason that he's not pumping things, he doesn't pump things, so I'm a bit confused.
And there's a reason
this
he doesn't
idea.
Pump things. I mean, there's a reason, and he said it so many times. It's like if you're a net purchaser of hamburgers, you don't want to pump them up. And he is a net purchaser of businesses. The last thing Buffett wants to do is see a market like this, like a massive, huge bubble. And he doesn't want to see that in his own stock either, for more reasons than just, I want to buy my own stock. It's also that he just feels it's not fair. Like when people are buying the stock at too high a price, he feels that that's unwarranted and they shouldn't do it. And he's come out times in the past and said, it's just too expensive, you know? Mm. And then of course it turns out you should have bought the hell out of it right there. But, that's Buffett and that's Munger, and that's why we love them so much, is that they're so different than everybody else in the world when it comes to this stuff. And they're shrugging off underperformance. It's like, hey, you know, 10 years, so what? You know, maybe, yeah, you should have bought the SPX. If you knew where we were going to go, you should have bought the SPX. On the other hand, there's massive untapped value in Berkshire Hathaway. No question in my mind.
Yes.
So, by the way, you should look at it. I mean, I'm not recommending anything or advice or whatever, but this is a business you should look into and try to understand. It's not a simple business. He owns like 60 or 70 private companies and a whole bunch of public ones. The accounting is labyrinth and hard to understand because he's got generally accepted accounting that he's got to do in what amounts to a fund.
And yeah. Yeah, I mean, the beginning of the letter where he basically like shows how annoyed he is with generally accepted accounting, forcing him to include all these write downs.
All the write downs and include the market change in the stocks that he owns as part of earnings or not earnings.
And
just
unrealized.
Like unrealized.
And yeah.
Horror show. So I think I think we had a couple
but
of
I just
fabulous
wanna end,
guys tell us a couple. Tell us some things that we need to hear over and over again. And I hope they live another 20 years each, at least, you know?
Oh, yes, please.
Please.
I mean, I want to say that I have heard from a few people like, oh, it was kind of a boring letter this year. Meh. I really enjoyed reading it. I felt like it was a really like nice boost
too.
To my value investing practice, to my rule one investing practice.
Yes, thank you.
It was really nice to read a defense of capitalism doing really good things. It was really nice to, as you pointed out, read about the middle of America getting a nice shout out and how much people there do. And it just gave me the warm and fuzzies. And I think for people doing this kind of practice, read the letter. It's worth it.
Yep.
It's not going to break any ground, but it doesn't have to break ground for it to be valuable.
And then listen to Charlie. It's well worth it. I mean, he says pithy little things like, you know, Jack Ma shouldn't have tweaked the nose of, I'm paraphrasing here, shouldn't have tweaked the nose of the Chinese government. He understands what kind of system they're in. In other words, and Charlie's like, and what they're proving in China is that you don't have to be a democracy to have a very successful economic system if you will allow capitalism to be there, right? I mean, so I think, you know, it's kind of a bit strange to just say that, you know, Jack got what he deserved if he's willing to do what he did in the Chinese government system. You just don't do that. So I like Charlie because he's so straightforward. And that's pretty politically incorrect right there.
He's so a curmudgeonly old man. He's fun to watch, for sure. The transcript doesn't convey it. That's for sure.
Go watch him. He's worth it. You'll get a good education. Yeah.
Oh, and last announcement. In the Berkshire letter, they announced that the annual meeting will be virtual this year again, which is not a surprise, but it's on May 1st.
May 1st.
And I thought it was so cute because Warren says, we all miss Charlie so much last year that the meeting's going to be in Los Angeles, which means that he and the two henchmen, sort of, they're not henchmen.
Greg Abel.
That's how I think of it.
Probably Ajit
John.
Jane.
They'll all go to LA because Charlie probably can't travel and be there with him. And they'll be broadcasting from there for all of us. So it was just so sweet. Like, clearly he really missed Charlie last year. And it was very sweet that he's going to go do that. And, I love and it.
And Warren has, after all, the Indefensible, which he can fly there.
That's the Is name that of his airplane?
Jet. Yeah. He calls it the Indefensible.
He does? Yeah. I didn't know that.
It's totally great. This is a guy that picks up pennies on elevators and he's got his own jet.
Amazing. He's got his exact change for his McDonald's breakfast.
Right on.
He's got his Indefensible airplane.
Just not even going to try to defend it. All right, you guys, we got to go.
Enjoy reading and watching those. All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And it's really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.